Hi, this is the Work Show, August issue. This past month, my old friend Joe Gioia, who I've known since college days, roomed with in Brooklyn and New York City, came through to give a reading of his new book from SUNY Albany Press, The Guitar in the New World, A Fugitive History. We decided to sit down and talk in my living room.
My name is Joe Gioia. I'm the author of a book called The Guitar in the New World that was published in April by the State University of New York Press up in Albany.
And you're in from Chicago.
I live in Chicago, where I've lived for the last 10 years.
Is this your first book?
It's the first widely published one. I self-published a book on Huckleberry Finn about, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. Which grew out of a series of blog posts that I did, a reader's guide to Huckleberry Finn. And through a friend in the printing business in Florida, I had a book designed and some copies printed up. And I was very happy with it. I was very quite proud of how it came out looking. And
at what point did you start to think of yourself as a writer or wanting to be a writer?
Well, okay, it's one of those things very early on, when you're a reader, certainly in high school or before, you get absorbed in, for me, it was detective stories and science fiction and sort of the pulp, Edgar Rice Burroughs and Robert E. Howard and H.P. Lovecraft.
Did you start writing, or did the idea of the writer suddenly come?
For whatever frustrations one has as an adolescent, for some people choose different things, sports, and I guess I chose writing. And I wrote a bunch of terrible short stories, which I was very happy to destroy before I even went to college. So I was, I was very, you know, very critical at a very young age.
Yeah. Were there writers or artists, people making money from their interests in your family or around your family?
No, I mean, my mother's family were very artistic people, and I always thought that I had whatever inclinations towards, you know, the creative impulse sort of came from that side. Mainly visual artists. Her grandfather was a photographer, a portrait photographer, and one of her aunts was a very talented sculptor. But, you know, very, you know, sort of small-scale bronzes, which she was able to do at a tiny studio behind her home. She was not a career artist.
Were there people, I mean, it was a time when you were in school, was there the idea that you could make a living from writing?
Well, you had the, you know, I'm also old enough to have been, you know, aware of that great, the sort of the popular idea of the newspaper reporter. You know, which goes from either, you know, those screwball comedies in the 30s of the front page, and really all the way through to, like, you know, Clark Kent, who is the mild-mannered reporter for the great metropolitan newspaper. And that was, you know, so you had this terrific figure of, yes, a writer who could sort of... And then, you know, I was very taken by the time I got to high school. I was reading, like, A.J. Liebling and Edmund Wilson, and, you know, these were, you know, working journalists and critics, and I was, you know, very, and again, you know, but the work at the time was in the 30s and 40s, and I was very interested in, I guess you'd say, you know, our grandparents' generation of writers who were mainly born around the turn of the century, of the 19th, 20th century.
And you studied English undergrad, and then you got a master's.
Got a master's in journalism from... Boston University.
And how did you decide to go for the master's in journalism after getting the BA?
Well, I was living in New York at the time, and, you know, sort of at sixes and sevens. And, you know, I woke up one morning after a particularly late night at the Mud Club and decided it would be a really good idea to, to leave New York and go to...
Well, this is always, how had you been making a living up until that point?
I was working as a temp. There was a temp agency in New York that got me work at a law office. And as a paralegal at the time was not a specialized field. And I had experience. I had worked as a messenger in a law office in Rochester, during high school. Sometimes after work, and then in the summer sometime. And so I was familiar with how law offices operated and what, you know, the errands one had to do to go to the different courts and the county clerk's office building. And so I, you know, it was a very natural kind of transition then to doing temp.
And so what did they teach you in journalism school?
Well, you know, to write on a deadline, mm-hmm. to sort of try and express yourself, you know, outside of the subjunctive case, and in clear declarative sentences, and find that which is the most important and bring it to the top of the story, you know, sort of get to the point, tell people, well, I guess you'd call it the who, what, when, where, why, and a very clear means of, you know, just telling the story and then getting out, I guess. That would be the...
And then when you came out with this new degree in hand, what ensued?
I went to Colorado to visit some friends and ended up working at a weekly paper in a small town west of Denver. And it was not... Well, the staff was so small that everyone sort of did everything, although I did not do typesetting. But I, you know, I sold ads and I wrote a column and I took pictures, and it was a nice experience. But I didn't want to stay in Colorado, so I came back.
Did you move back to the city?
Then I went back to New York. Yeah.
And then was it at that point that you started working in with magazines run photography, or
got work at a again through this temp agency, but that I then hired on as a researcher at a travel magazine for doctors.
Diversion.
Diversion magazine, which, you know, sort of had its day in the sun. And because I was the only person in the office who knew how to read a light meter, I was sort of given the camera column to preside, you know, either edit or assign. I don't think I ever wrote a camera column for him. But then as a result of that, you know, you then get invited to all the press conferences and the lunches when they're introducing new products, and you sort of enter the field, and the field I entered was, you know, a photographic photo writing.
Had you been shooting before then much?
Well, growing up in Rochester, you know, you're given a camera at a very young age. And so I was always very, you know, able, you know, and willing to take pictures, but I didn't start taking it seriously until I was given some assignments with the paper in Colorado. High school football games, there was a youth rodeo, which I thought was really interesting, taking pictures of, you know, kids riding horses and bulls. And so when I got back to New York is when I got a first camera, and I started taking classes at the ICP, the International Center of Photography, when it was in a small little building on Fifth Avenue, about 95th or 6th Street. Moved to Chicago and It was at a time in my life. A lot of stuff had happened to me, and you know, the sort of things that you get divorced, a parent dies. You know, I was living in Minneapolis at the time, and I bought a guitar. I mean, it's one of those things where you have this idea that you're going to do something down the line, and you never quite get around to it, right? And then I decided, well, that's it. One day I went out and I got a guitar. I'd always wanted to play, and I had friends who were musicians, good musicians, and I figured I could get lessons without too much trouble. And they'd advised me what sort of guitar to get, and so I bought this guitar, and you know, it started making a G chord and a D, and then around, you know, that all these things were sort of happening, which was part of that, and then I moved not long afterwards, a few months later, to Chicago. I thought I needed a change of scene, and I didn't have a regular job up there. I was working at a small theater, and I thought I'd get another theater job in Chicago. But what ended up happening was that when I was back in Rochester visiting relatives, I'd mentioned to my father's older brother that I was learning how to play guitar, and he surprised me by saying that there was, in fact, a family connection. And in that his uncle, my grandmother's older brother, had made guitars and mandolins at a small factory, a workshop he had in Buffalo. And that's when I realized that, you know, whatever sort of creative impulse I may have had, may not necessarily have come from my mother's family at all, that in fact my paternal grandmother's family were very musically inclined. It was like a family of musicians, and so I'd sort of like fallen into that. And so that made me, of course, very curious about who this man was. He was 17 years older than my grandmother, almost to be of a different generation. Mm-hmm. And he died in 1946, which, you know, years and years before my parents even met. You know. And I started doing some research on his life and times, and sort of one thing led to another, and it turned out he was a very interesting man. He had come to America in 1888 from Sicily. He went to Buffalo, and he was fairly successful in a lot of his projects. He had a small construction company, and he ended up owning some land and running a small bank, and he had a farm. And he was a very respected member of the community in Buffalo, and but was kind of, you know, laid low by the crash in 29 and the Depression. Mm-hmm. But he, you know, I guess he still had a factory building downtown where he had been in the macaroni business, but that had gone out of, you know, that ended with the crash. And, you know, for some reason, at the age of, I don't know, like 65, he decides to start making musical instruments. And what was so interesting to me was that the instruments he decides to make were archtop jazz guitars, which, you know, this is before there were electric guitars, really. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the archtop was the most, you know, up-to-date, modern, sort of American instrument that you could imagine, you know, and he was not producing these little nostalgic instruments that were sort of looking back towards the old country, but utterly up-to-date, you know, new, and he in fact had patented a design for his own kind of guitars. He had some ideas about how to make guitars better, so he was a very, you know, sort of a man of two worlds, you know.
So was this, did that start to coalesce into the idea of a book, or just...
Well, that was the, you know, I mean, I decided when I got to Chicago that maybe a book would be a, you know, something. Because I, again, you know, you always wanted to play guitar, I got a guitar. I always wanted to write a book, I started writing a book. It was...
It was
one of those times, yeah.
And so then with the book, I mean... I mean, just explain briefly where you go in this book, because you go several very interesting places.
It's a rambling, tangential story, and it's sort of reflective of just how I sort of see things and think about things. But when you pull on one thread and then another sort of comes apart, or you discover. And so, well, for example, I was in Buffalo, and I was at the library there, and their newspaper microfilm department, and I'm there to research sort of what the newspaper reporting was of the Italian community, basically from about 1890 to 1910, 1920. When my relatives were living there, and quite often, like, finding him, my great uncle Carmelo, his name was Carmelo, mentioned in these accounts of prominent emigrant businessmen, and the quote unquote these success stories. But while I was in Buffalo, while I was reading about all this stuff, I started reading about the 1901 World's Fair, the Pan American Exposition, which meant a great deal to the Italians living in Buffalo at the time. A lot of the guys who were in building trades, stonemasons and woodworkers, that was the big project. You had farmland. You went from farmland to this kind of vast amusement park, 1 mile square, mm-hmm. in the space of a year. Well, 16 months. So it was this huge building project. And then you get caught up, then you start reading about the fair itself, because here's the newspapers that are published every day, and they're writing about what's going on inside the fair, and like all these things, from something called Venice in America, which was really the first broadly sort of positive expression of Italian popular culture, music and singing and food, mm-hmm. Presented for Middle America, for the great Anglo-Saxon middle class, who were the people that were coming to the fair in Buffalo in 1901. And then there was also something called the Indian Congress, which was directly across the Midway from Venice in America. Here are the new Italians, and here you have Geronimo, who was in Buffalo in 1901. You tell people that Geronimo went to William McKinley's funeral, the president who was shot and killed in Buffalo in 1901. It's a strange, this very strange and sort of forgotten chapter in, American history. And so then, I guess the long way of saying that, that I had to write about that. I mean, that was, you go down one road and you sort of find all this scenery that you have to somehow bring into the work at large. Like this.
one of those things is going to happen to you. You get the mold something like this.
Delta.
That was when I first moved to Minneapolis, and a friend of mine, a writer named Peter Olson, had gotten an assignment to drive down Highway 61 from St. Paul to New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And Peter, I was very involved in photography at the time, and I was taking a lot of pictures. And Peter called me up and said, "Would you like to come along, and you know, take pictures for the story?" I said, sure, you know. So that would have been the spring of 1996. You know, music has always appealed to me, in Rochester, you know, the Philharmonic. When I was a boy, the Philharmonic was a tremendous presence, you know, and so you know you went to hear a lot of music, sort of classical, and then I don't know if anyone from around there is listening, but there was this tremendous AM radio station, you know, WBBF, in the mid-60s. And they, you know, they, very eclectic. I mean, they would play, you know, Motown and you know, Elvis Presley and Frank Sinatra. And, you know, there were everything that made, you know, the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and the Supremes. I mean, that's, you know, and there was that itself, you know, was a you know, tremendous musical education. So
how did you get from all of that to, I mean, through into the Southern hillbilly?
My theory of the Native American influence in the blues and country music. That kind of, well, you know, that just sort of happened in the course of the research. You know, I was sort of
bringing these different elements.
Yeah, you know, because I'm reading a lot of books about music, and that's the other thing too, is that you know you live in a city like Chicago, which has got a tremendous public library system and a wonderful public library that has not only shelves and shelves and shelves of books on music, but also CDs, you know, in their collection. And so it was, that itself was a tremendous education, and you know the research was really more fun than the writing. But then I don't know, there was at one point where I'm looking at, it was a map of Cherokee Indian territory after the Revolutionary War. And it was basically sort of eastern Tennessee and western Virginia and sort of northern Georgia and Alabama. And it was exactly what is now considered the cradle of country music. Mm-hmm. And then a penny kind of dropped. It's like, well, wait a minute, you know, what are we missing here, you know? And like I said, I'd been reading, you know, music books and was sort of familiar with the sort of the blues stories for, you know, for quite some time. And then it just sort of hit me that the subject of, you know, the related subject really of how music is transmitted across generations and through cultures, you know, so you know, like that became the broader topic of the book. And I had read this a terrific by Monin at Midnight. That's a really good biography of Howlin' Wolf. Mm-hmm. And you know, and just the name, Howlin' Wolf, all right? You think, all right, well, does that sound like a Native American name to you? It is. I mean, his grandfather was a Choctaw Indian, which, you know, Wolf talked about frequently. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he said he had gotten, you know, his mentor, his teacher, his guitar teacher was Charlie Patton. And he says in the book, and I use this as an epigraph to my book, he says, yeah, you know who taught me how to play? Charlie Patton. You know, Charlie Patton was an Indian. And then, you know, you sort of follow that line. All right, well, you know, you go to the WPA Guide for Mississippi, you know, the books that were published during the Depression, you know, mm-hmm. And then you read that, in fact, you know, there were about 3,000 or 4,000 Choctaw Indians who did not go to Oklahoma Territory when the South was ethnically cleansed in the 1830s, mm-hmm. but in fact stayed in what was then the swamp of the Yazoo River Delta. And then, you know, like 50 years later, after the Civil War, it's like the 1880s, and the cotton land throughout the South has been exhausted by overcultivation and boll weevils. And you've got a syndicate of planters, of plantation owners, that start to drain the Yazoo Delta swamp mm-hmm. to create what we now call the Mississippi Delta, this vast flat plain of incredibly rich soil. And, you know, lo and behold, the people who had been living there the whole time now appear as African Americans because, well, you know, in the South, if you had like a black grandparent or a great grandparent, you weren't white or Native American anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, all of a sudden you became a black person who had no rights whatsoever. You know,
yeah.
You know that was very handy too because you have what once were a sovereign, independent people that did in fact have some treaty rights. You know, with a stroke of a pen, you turn them all into blacks who have no rights whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
That solves any number of problems. And in fact, I think that status, you know, better to be considered African American and allowed to stay than to be labeled an Indian and forced to move.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think a lot of people made that choice, that very painful choice, you know, when the chips were down. So.
And then on the other side, in the Appalachians, you followed.
You
it,
had
followed
yes,
it,
you had you know well, you know who's the first family of country music? The Carter family. A.P. Carter was his known Cherokee Indian ancestry.
Mm-hmm.
That's known. And if you see photographs of A.P. Carter as a young man, very striking. You know, native. You know, mm-hmm. indigenous. Features, and you can sort of go down a road where you don't want to go because, you know, it doesn't matter what people look like. You know, tribal status is, in fact, you know, conveyed through the birth, you know, kinship with the mother. It's matrilineal, and people are adopted into tribes, and so. But you know, you can sort of see a cultural, you know, connection. In A.P. Carter, and you know, there's just that high and lonesome sound. I mean, there's something in American mountain music that you do not hear in the Celtic examples in, you know, Nova Scotia, for example, mm-hmm. New Brunswick. You know, it's the same root, if you will, but there's you read these histories of American music and. And the writer usually says something along the lines of, well, the harshness of the American experience, or something happened in the interior, the vast interior of the mountains that hardened, you know, into the sound that we... And, you know, what it was just about 200 years of Indian wars,
yeah.
You know, fighting and kidnapping, and or, you know, just these communities of people who, in fact, were, you know... mixed race, you know, and all they wanted was to be left alone and not bothered. And again, when the Cherokee were forced to leave the South, they were only interested, you know, the Southerners who were clearing them out were only interested in bottom land, flat land for farming.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you lived up in a mountain holler, no one's going to go up there and try and drag you out. I mean, that's pointless. First of all, they're not going to come back. You know, second, the land is worthless. So yeah, so about 2,000 to 3,000 Cherokee, by some estimates, managed to stay up in the hills.
And there's a whole bunch, yeah, where I grew up down in Virginia too.
Oh really?
Not Cherokee. It was a different tribe.
But, yeah.
But how much music did you discover through this whole process?
Well, you know, again, like I didn't come to this cold, and but then you start listening. What you do is listening again with new ears, mm-hmm. and then you start hearing stuff. And I think, actually, I was not all that familiar with Charlie Patton's work when I started.
I want away.
Something that stokes one's dreams of making a living, of working in this way? Is it an abeyance from it?
I have to confess that I was able to self-finance this. You know, after my mother passed away, I got a certain amount of money, and I did not have to be real concerned about, you know, of course I lived in a budget, and you know, I was not jetting around the world, but it did pay for a significant amount of free time. And, you know, research trips. To mm-hmm. I went to Buffalo 2 or 3 times to do research in the library there. And also Rochester. But there I was, you know, I was able to stay with relatives.
What was your, just as an aside on this, what was kind of, did you have like a daily
yes.
working regime?
Oh, yes. Yeah, if you are, I mean, there are writers who write every day. I do not. But if I have a project that I'm working on, absolutely. You have to sit down, and whether it's for 20 minutes or 3 hours, you have to do something every day. Mm-hmm. And you know, Flannery O'Connor in her letters is very adamant on that point. The duty of the writer is to, you know, put down that work every day, and even, you know, to be willing to tear up that work at the end of the day or at the end of the month or, you know, when the project is sort of forming itself. But no, the daily application is critical.
And what about the kind of the inner ups and downs as you're wrestling with the material and its quality or quantity or?
I'll tell you what, I first got off the ground because I'm very self-critical, you know, and you have to switch off that discursive mind. And to do that, what I decided to do was to sit down and just with a yellow pad and a pencil and just write at least one page. And then if, you know, I sort of got on a roll and I had a page and a half, then I wasn't finished until I had something to finish that second page. If you know what I never left a part of a page done in that session. And some days it would go really fast. I would have like two pages in 45 minutes. Great. You know, and then it was, then I was, and then, very important, turn the page over, put it in a box, and you don't look at it. Uh-huh. And I wrote every day for 6 months, every day for 6 months that way. So then at the end of 6 months, well, do the math, I had a stack of pages, about 200, you know, more, which then, you know, handwritten, which then I spent another month or two entering, you know, like typing into a word processor, you know, my computer. And that is another stage of work, you know. I mean, and then you begin editing there, you know. And you can sort of throw away the stuff that doesn't work. You can sort of then find things that were promising, but, you know, you need more work. And then you can find those wonderful pages where everything is just perfect and they sort of form the frame of what's to come. So that was my method.
And at what point did you start to, figure out how to take it out there to find that other, that horrible half of the equation where somebody actually prints the thing and supposedly takes it out into the public?
I had half of it written, mainly the American music part I had written. I would say the hardest parts for me to write for different reasons. One was the family memoir stuff that's in, it's not really memoir, but the family chronicle stuff that's in there. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, and then the section on the 1901 fair, which really took on a life of its own. Mm-hmm. But I did have the music sections written, which I sent, a friend recommended an agent in New York. And I sent it to him with an outline for the rest of the book. And he replied very positively. And so I had an agent. And that, you know, it's someone who can help or at least provide a certain validation or moral support. And so then I spent another probably year and a half finishing it. And then he tried to sell it and was, you know, in that time, the book business kind of imploded. Uh-huh. So, that's a whole nother story. It was turned down about 25 different places. Mm-hmm. And
how is that, working through that process?
It's really hard. Really, really hard. Because, well, again, part of the problem, you have to be a little crazy when you're in the middle of working on something like that, because you believe in it completely. Mm-hmm. And in my case, you know, here I've sort of evolved or come up with this theory of American music entirely at odds with the prevailing myth, mm-hmm, of the, you know, the sort of the African roots of the blues. And so I was a little, I don't know. I mean, I can't quite describe my frame of mind.
What is this that I can see with Ozzy hand taking hold on me? I am death and none can excel. I'll open the door to heaven or hell. Oh, death, can't you spare me over till another year? Till another year. But if someone would trade, couldn't you call some other day? Children's prayed, the preachers preached, time mercy is out your reach. I'll fix your feet so you can't walk, I'll lock your jaw so you can't talk. Close your eyes so you can't see this very air, come go with me. Death, I come, take the soul, leave the body and leave it cold. Drop the flesh off of the frame, the earth and worm both have a claim. Oh, death, oh, death, can't you spare me over till another year? Oh, death, oh, death, please spare me over till another year. Mother, come to my bed, place cold towel upon my head. My head is warm, my feet is cold, death is moving up on my soul. Oh, death, are you treating me? Close my eyes so I can see. You hurt my body, you make me cold, you rule my life right out of my soul. Death, can't you spare me over till another year? Oh, death, oh, death, please spare me over till another year. Oh, death, please sit at my age, please don't take me at this stage. My wealth is all at your command, if you will move your icy hand. Young, the rich, or poor, all alike with me, you know. No wealth, no land, no silver, no gold, nothing satisfied me but your soul. Oh, death, oh, death, can't you spare me over till another year?
And this hard work that you've done fit into this world of money that we live in these days? Does it anymore?
I don't think so. No,
is it separated?
Yeah. No, there is just not. I mean, I've now become very sensitized to, you know, book review sections in, you know, online. Mm-hmm. And it's really sort of shocking to see that, you know, these sections that are ostensibly devoted towards books are really writing about books as how they're connected to movies or TV shows or, you know, pop culture, you know, phenomenon. But just the idea of reviewing a book as a book in a kind of a literary tradition, which, you know, guys like, you know, Edmund Wilson or Lionel Trilling, you know, sort of stood for. There was once upon a time in this country, not oh so long ago, you know, H.L. Mencken. You know, very smart men who were able to write about literature for a broad reading public that was both male and female, that, you know, was very, you know, it was a very rich ecosystem. And you had writers really from, like, starting with, you know, Theodore Dreiser, I would propose all the way through, like, Norman Mailer and John Updike, mm-hmm. in the 50s, where, you know, literature was taken seriously and written about seriously and broadly and in an accessible and popular way, and that's all gone away now. I think the public eye is now directed mainly towards television, and now the internet, you know, and YouTube. And
do people still major in English?
Yeah, I think they do. And I don't want to, like, you know, kick over the hornet's nest here, but, you know, the English department has changed. Mm-hmm. You know, theory is taught now. And I think the notion, Well, even when, you know, back in the day when you had, like, sort of, like, New Criticism and you know, guys like Berryman writing criticism, and there was always at heart the idea that one read for pleasure. Mm-hmm. You know, that one was sort of enriched and enlivened by literature, yeah, however one defines literature. And of course, the definition of literature has changed
a
great deal.
The language of culture, in a way, you talked about.
And that, in fact, was a pleasurable thing to do. You know, and, you know, with over, you know, a bottle of scotch and a carton of cigarettes, you know, to use the Berryman example. You know, I mean, you had these intense encounters, not only with literature, but with people who shared your, you know, love of literature. And now I think, you know, with theory, it's a very, you know, you get these, you know, sort of fascinating ideas about where literature comes from and where it goes and how it sort of fits together and falls apart. But the focus, I think, is less upon reading as a pleasurable experience and more as a means of decoding, you know, a message to, I don't know, mm-hmm. between a man and the unknowable God. Who knows? I mean, it's...
And does that then, I mean, yeah, at the same time, there seems to be a separation from, you know, that the money aspect is something that's, it's either luck or...
Well, what...
And so when literature and the art separate itself from money, does it bring it back to its beginnings, like in the early 19th century or 18th century,
well,
or...
No one but a blockhead writes for anything but money. This is what Dr. Johnson said in, 1778? Mm-hmm. You know, and I've always taken that, you know, advice very seriously. That when I was in New York writing, I only wrote for money, and, you know, it was magazine work. Mm-hmm. And so sort of, and the idea was that, I, you know, when I would write a book, when I wrote this book, that it would, in fact, you know, pay off somehow, you know, maybe not with a fat contract, but as a means of sort of accessing a wider world of you know, culture and movie rights, who knows. But the perfect example that we have before us today, the woman who wrote the Harry Potter books, was it J.K. Rowling, mm-hmm. decided she wanted to write a book and publish it under a pseudonym. Are you familiar?
Yeah.
Yeah, this came out a couple weeks ago. And it was, you know, I guess a very well-wrought mystery novel, which got very good reviews in England and sold all of 450 copies.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
So then somebody,
and then someone spilled the beans, oh my God, you know. And now it's an international bestseller because, you know, her name is attached to it. And that's a very strange, I mean, you almost don't want that to happen to anybody, really. And that's just, you know, I mean, yeah, I mean, your money is, you know, you go to any bookstore and the books you are going to see on the front shelf, well, I shouldn't say any bookstore, mm-hmm. any large bookstore of a chain variety, the books that you see when you walk in, you know, they've paid to have those things there. And it's all of, you know, these large publishing houses, which are kind of owned by two or three companies now. And it's a very, you know, are you familiar with the book The Gift by Lewis Hyde?
Yeah, I've not read it, but I love it.
Well, Mr. Hyde teaches now at our alma mater. Mm-hmm. And it's a very, and he makes the distinction between work and labor. And work is what you do for money. Labor is what you do to bring out what the gift inside oneself. And I think that's a very interesting. And he, you know, I mean, he will. I mean, he's got a whole section of the book dedicated to sort of explicating this. I'm giving it just the merest gloss. But if you think of work as what you do for money, and labor is what you do to express yourself, then things sort of become a lot clearer, and you know.
And so, from kind of to take that one step farther and draw this to a close, what have you found through the labor of creating this book?
Well, one follows a path to the end, you know. I and then there's another path. And it was very satisfying just to see it through and to have people read it and you know, friends read it and they say, well, you know, I mean, I was afraid I wouldn't like it, or, you know, I didn't know it was going to be this good. You know, there's that tremendous, well, you know, it's a small thing, but there's feeling of validation. And
the question is, what have you gained through work over your lifetime versus what you've gained through labor at this point?
Yeah. Well, I've gained very little through work, really. And labor, you know, labor is like, well, you know, it's there was a lot of stuff in there about you know, a very personal nature, and just being able to approach it in such a way as to make it clear to others, and, you know, sort of, you know, broadly fitting the family dynamic into the frame of history was a very interesting aspect of the book for me. And just how our own sort of smaller patterns then connect to not only the wider ones of what's going on now, but how those then sort of go back into time, and that there are these, you know, these links that you can follow these sort of lines through across time and events. And that, so, you know, I think I got a greater sort of appreciation of kind of where I came from, and, you know, the sense, you know, of very satisfying feeling of having, you know, accomplished something that I'm very proud of. So.
Hi, my name is Paul Smart, and this has been the August issue of The Work Show on WGXC. Music this month was by Howlin' Wolf doing Smokestack Lightning, Picking My Way from Eddie Lane, Andrew and Jim Baxter doing The Moore Girl, Down the Dirty Road Blues by the great Charlie Patton, Doc Boggs doing Oh Death, and a Choctaw Indian hymn from the great Delta, Uba Isht Taloa. Next month, we'll be presenting for the September Harvest issue of The Work Show, Donna Williams of Athens in her new Feel Goods experiment, in which we'll be riding along with Donna and meeting her various workers as she delivers farm goods throughout our area. This has been The Work Show. Glad to have spoken to you. My name is Paul Smart. Keep on working. Achok maka ilino ke lahin la cho anok filik ke pesa kanaki ya pinok hamlod piyok chali chahi. Hatak yo sho, pinchi sa chuk makar.